All right, let's go to the third chapter of the book of Daniel. We're going to look at the three Hebrews in the fiery furnace today. We had gone down through verse 18 in the last lesson. These three Jews were very defiant. They said, "We will not bow down and worship this great metallic man, no matter what may happen to us." So they remained very defiant. And so, beginning there at verse 19 down through verse 25, we're going to see something about the harmless furnace. Now, it was not in the absolute sense harmless, but when God put His protective hedge around these three Hebrew children, it was a harmless furnace at that point. So in verse 19, about the best way I knew to describe that was to use a term that I heard quite a bit when I was growing up. Sometimes we used to say that a man was as mad as fire, and that meant he's just about as mad as he could get. Well, this king was as mad as fire. Not only was he as mad as fire, but he was mad enough to throw some people in the fire. So he was really mad as fire, wasn't he? So let's read that 19th verse. "Then was Nebuchadnezzar full of fury, filled up, as mad as he could get. And the form of his visage was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Therefore he spake and commanded that they should heat the furnace 1 7 times more than it was wont to be heated." So here we have a very angry king. He's been tolerant up to this point. But when they have told him they will disregard the law of his kingdom, he has become as mad as he can get. And he begins to act like most people do when they get very angry, a bit irrational. About the nearest that some of us come to insanity is when we get mad. So the king is getting so mad that he's going to do some things that are not in the best interest of his kingdom, not even in the best interest of some of his subjects. So here we had three Hebrews standing unconquered there before the master conqueror of the world itself. I would say that was one of the most profound public professions of faith that anyone had ever made. In the face of death, they were standing up for what they believed. Now, the furnace was heated 7 times hotter than normal. It's a little hard to bring out. Even our version is not altogether clear here. It says they should heat the furnace 1 7 times more than it was wont to be heated. Nearly all agree that in the Hebrew, as well as the English there, it suggests that the furnace would be 7 times hotter than it normally would have been. So I suppose he told them to pile in a big lot of back sticks and put in as much wood as they could find, and get it, I mean, hot. Because he wanted to fry these fellows good and make an example out of them. And as you might suppose, he gives the command that they be cast into this furnace. And he commanded the most mighty men, mighty in strength, strong, able-bodied men of the court that he trusted, men that were the great immortals of his kingdom, perhaps. He commanded the most mighty men that were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. So now he's commanded that they be cast into the furnace. Why do you suppose that he had these men bound? Well, maybe they would have gotten them right up there to the mouth of the furnace, ready to throw them in, and they would have hightailed it down the road or something. So he wasn't going to take any chance. He wasn't going to give Jehovah any way out. He was going to bind these men by the strongest soldiers that he had so as to prevent any possibility of escape whatsoever. He was going to make sure that no god would deliver them out of his hands. At least he thought so. So he has removed all possibility of escape, it would seem. They're bound, and they're going to be cast into a furnace where they'll almost be annihilated in a very brief space of time. So it looks like that indeed these boys are going to be fried in the fire. God has some other plans. So they cast him in the furnace there in verse 21 to 23. That is, these strong, able-bodied men are going to cast the three Hebrews into the furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their hosen, and their hats. Now that sounds to me like a pretty good binding job. You bind a man so much that you've covered up his turban and his clothes and everything so that everything just about he's got on has got a rope around it. There's not much possibility of escape. The word hat there is really a turban-like. And the coat, of course, is a mantle, something like an overcoat, as we might term it. So they're completely wrapped up in their clothes. Now, why do you suppose they wrapped them up in their clothes? Even their hats or turbans were covered over. Well, we know that cloth burns very rapidly. It catches a fire real quick, far more so than the skin of the human body. So the idea is that he's more or less putting the kindling on them so they'll burn quick, to put it in very country terms. About like putting a little dose of kerosene on them because it's going to make them ignite all that much more sooner. And their other garments, every bit of the clothing they had on, is now securely bound by ropes. And were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. He didn't throw them out at the edge, but he put them right in the midst of it. And probably the fact that these men had to carry them out and throw them into the midst gives us the reason why they themselves died from being that near the flame. They were not to throw them around the edge, which would have been the easiest thing. They were to throw them into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. You say, well, if their life was in danger, why did they obey the king? Well, he'd have thrown them in anyway if they didn't. So they didn't have much choice. They had to do whatever the king told them to do there. So the strong men are going to cast them in. And the idea is to turn them into human torches. To literally just burn them up on the spot. To fry them good. So it goes on to say there, therefore, because the king's commandment was urgent, do it now, not later, and the furnace exceeding hot, the flame of the fire slew those men that took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So there's no possibility here of there being only a little small fire kindled, as some liberals have supposed. It's a big fire that's burning. So big is the fire that even the men that have to throw them out into the middle of it are themselves devoured by the flame. So then what we're saying is that these very strong men that cast them into the furnace had their own flesh burned. They were burned to death. They became burning torches, perhaps. Now that's going to make the miracle all the more greater, because had these men not gotten burned themselves, we might have supposed that the fire was just very small. But bear in mind that the furnace is heated 7 times hotter than normal. It's not a little fireplace, it's a great furnace, like you would heat brick in or tile or something to make them firm and solid. So it's a great bonfire that's burning there. So what a miracle we're about to see here. What a miracle this is going to be. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. I can just imagine that the old king over there kind of wiped his hands that way clean and said, that takes care of that now. We put a stop to these defiant Jews. There are torches by now. There's probably just no more than a red hot coal left to the fellows. But I don't know just how this furnace was constructed. I've often wondered. I've seen various artists' conceptions of it, and they're probably near the truth of what it looked like. Some of the artists of the Bible have drawn it as, well, sort of like a bottle, big old round thing like. And, of course, the smoke goes out the top. And down here at the bottom, then, there's an open place where you can see up in it. There had to be some way for the king to see up in it. So I would assume that he's going to sit some distance away where he can see up in it like. And anybody knows that if you build a big fire, you got to have air to get in on the bottom. So it had to have some sort of holes down under the bottom to let the air get in, especially if they were going to make it seven times hotter. It had to be that way. So I would imagine that it was some great structure, something like a bottle or like a ball with a hole in the top and holes down at the bottom. So this fire could be seen. And you could tell how hot it was down there right in the bottom in the coals and all of that, to make it all the more scary to the people that would have seen it. And so the old king, he's sitting out there and he can see the furnace, and the other people can see it too. So these fellows, they're bound now. They go right down into the middle of the fire. And so the flames are leaping out the top, and these fellows that threw them in, they've been devoured by the flames too. And so the king now, he's not been very wise. He's lost some of his best soldiers. Some of his mighty, some of his strong men have been killed because of his anger, requiring that these men be thrown into the very midst of the furnace. In a way, a ridiculous command. They could have been thrown in the edge and have died just as quick if it was indeed seven times hotter. Now, what I see there in that great furnace that's burning, I see a type of the fires of hell that God has set to burning for the wicked. Over here in the book of Matthew, the Lord Jesus speaks about hell as being a furnace of fire. Now, Nebuchadnezzar had a literal furnace that was burning there because it actually burned people up. And would have burned up even these Hebrews had it not been for a miracle of God. Well, there's a sense in which God has made him a big furnace for people that don't worship him, don't serve him, just like the king did there. In Matthew chapter 13 and verse 40, "And therefore the tares are gathered and burned in the fire. So shall it be in the end of this world. The Son of Man shall send forth his angels," like the king did his mighty men. God's going to send the mighty angels. "And they shall gather out of his kingdom all things that offend, and them which do iniquity," all the sinners. What's going to happen to them? "And shall cast them into the furnace of fire," just like the king did. "There shall be wailing and gnashing of teeth." Now, why will people mash their teeth in hell? Well, the only time that I've ever seen a man really gnash his teeth is when he's extremely angry or when he's in great pain. Well, in this case, it's going to be that he's in great pain. He's going to weep. He's going to wail. That means more than just crying. That means wailing is to the point of uncontrollable emotion and grief. Not only weeping, but wailing because of the intense pain that will be suffered there by the wicked. So in a sense, there's quite a parallel between the furnace that Nebuchadnezzar the king made and the furnace in hell that the King of Kings has made for all of those that will not worship him and serve him. Now let's pass on from that practical thought there of a type of hellfire to Christ being with his suffering people. I believe that the Lord's with us all the time, but sometimes we know it more so when we suffer. We realize it more. Don't you believe that God had already been with these boys all the time they'd been there in Babylon? Certainly. But his presence was more manifest. It was more understood by them when this event took place. So there's a lot of practical truth here in verse 24 and 25. And so let's read that now. "Then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astonished and rose up in haste," jumped up out of his seat, "and spake and said unto his counselors," that's the lawyers, the mighty men of the court and all of that, "Did not we cast three men bound into the midst of the fire?" They answered and said unto him, unto the king, "True, O king." He answered and said, "Lo, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." Boy, was he in for a surprise that day. He never thought anything like this was going to happen. He said, "No God can deliver you out of my hands." But he was mistaken, wasn't he? All right, the king, he's startled. He can see into the furnace from wherever he has positioned himself. And so he begins to inquire at the hands of these high officials if there's any possibility that another man might have got in there that he didn't know about. Was there another offender, he said, that was cast into the furnace? Did maybe one of the mighty men, did he accidentally fall down in there when he threw him in? Where is this fourth man coming from? Are you absolutely sure that only three men were thrown in? Of course, these counselors, these lawyers and the like, they said, well, as far as we know, said only three men were cast into the furnace. So he said, well, there seemed to be a little problem here. There's another fellow in there. Not only is there a problem in that we've got an extra man added, there's not any hurt on the men that's in that furnace. And furthermore, they're not bound anymore. They're loosed. They're loosed. The only thing that has really burned up is the king's rope. Their clothes have not burned. Their hats have not burned. But the ropes have burned. That's all that has burned. The ropes of the king. Now, who was this fourth man? I believe the king was right about it. Here is a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ. Now, some make a big to-do here because the Hebrew actually reads, the form is like a god. Well, the king would have been speaking there after his own understanding. But he realized that this being in there was a god. And he surely knew that it was the God of the Hebrews. So that's Christ. So any way you want to look at it, you still come right back to the same idea that it's Jesus Christ. So you can take that translation or you can take ours, which I am inclined to believe is correct in this case. And you still have the fourth man in the fire being the Son of God in a pre-incarnate appearance. God Himself has appeared visibly with His people. Think about how that Christ will be with the 144,000 on Mount Zion. He's with them. He is with His church visibly when He was here in the world and all of that. So here is Christ being made real to His suffering people. And that was quite a miracle of preservation. Not all of God's people that's been cast into the fire have been so fortunate. Many of them have burned. They've burned at a stake. They've burned in the furnace. They burned in houses. They burned in dens and caves of the earth. But God, for a reason known only to Him, has preserved these three Hebrews, proving that He is a God that can deliver out of the hands of King Nebuchadnezzar. I don't know, maybe these boys recited Isaiah 43:2 when they were cast in the fire. I've often wondered about that because the book of Isaiah was already written at that time. And the book of Isaiah 43:2 said, when thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee. And through the rivers, they shall not overflow thee. When thou walkest through the fire, thou shalt not be burned, neither shall the flame kindle upon thee. And then there was another sweet promise of God in the Psalms. In Psalms 138, in verse 7. Though I walk in the midst of trouble, thou wilt revive me. Thou shalt stretch forth thine hand against the wrath of mine enemies. King's mad. He's an enemy of God's people. And thy right hand shall save me. Well, it was not only the right hand that was here. It was the whole Son of God in the form of a man with his right and his left hand to deliver His people out of the fiery furnace. But you know, in a sense, He didn't deliver them from the furnace until a bit later. Right now, He's done no more than preserve them alive. God's not going to take the 144,000 Israelites out of the tribulation, but He's going to preserve them alive all the way through it. Just like these boys, you see. So He did not deliver them immediately from the fire. He preserved them. They waited in the fire for a time, just like Jesus waited in the tomb in Joseph's garden. Just like Paul and Peter and Silas waited for a time in jail. Just like Noah waited for a time in the ark. God wants His people sometime to wait in the fires of suffering and trial. So the only thing that they suffered there was they lost their bond. Often the bonds of sin and the fetters of mortality are snapped in the furnace. You show me the strongest Christians that ever lived. I mean real Bible believers. that'll live and die for what they believe. And I'll show you somebody that's gone through many trials and tribulations. That's what it takes to make strong Christians, is to go into the furnace of affliction. And so if you want to be a strong Christian, you want to have the bonds of sin and the fetters to snap, then you may have some fiery trials to go through. Don't expect life to be easy. Don't expect the cross to be light. It'll be heavy. Don't expect the race to soon be over. It'll be hard and long. Don't expect the battle to end with the passing of a day. It'll be long and enduring. There'll be many times that you'll have to fight the good fight of faith. So here we learn that God sometimes permits His servants to suffer trial. He'll preserve them in trial. But in the world, He promised us we'd have tribulation. And through much tribulation, we'll enter into the kingdom of God. Now, why do you suppose that God allows His people to suffer? Well, to point out the difference between the wheat and the tares sometimes. The children of God and the children of Belial. I believe that's why that it takes place. So God's purpose here was to separate pretenders from true professors. You say, well, there were some other people there from Judea. They didn't get thrown in the fire. No, because they were false professors. They didn't really believe in the true religion of Jehovah. They had bowed down. They had worshipped idols. They had violated the first and second commandment. But here are some fellows that wouldn't bow down. You know, I wonder, we have so many professed Christians in America. If God's not going to allow us to suffer to separate the sheep from the goats. And I wonder if that time may not be closer than what we may think. Say, well, you mean we may suffer like they do in Russia and other places? It's possible. The government right now has made an all-out war against the church in the last few years. If you keep up with the news, you know what's going on. The IRS is giving churches fits right now all over the country. Various other things are happening that are most fearful to me. And I do not know what the future holds. The time may come when we too will suffer. No, not go into the great tribulation, but suffer, as our Baptist forefathers did in times past. And if so, it will be for the purpose of separating the pretenders from the true professors, the sheep from the goats. Now, God could preserve His people in hell, even if Satan did cast them into it. So don't worry about one of God's children going down to hell and burning up. Because we learn right here that God could preserve them if He wanted to. Of course, He's not going to cast them down there. But I said if He did, He could preserve them like He did these boys. Well, we're going to see a convinced, and maybe I ought to say almost converted king in what follows here. He said, no God can deliver out of my hands, but a God has delivered out of His hands. And here is God's Son. This is the only time that I recall in the Old Testament that Christ is called the Son of God in the sense of His, like in the book of John, He's called the Son of God many times. So let's go down now in verse 26 to 28 and see a convinced king. He's at least convinced that Jehovah can deliver the Hebrews. Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the mouth of the burning fiery furnace, and spake and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, ye servants of the Most High God, come forth and come hither. He doesn't, in the absolute sense there, he doesn't command them to come out, does he? He is the king, he had the right to, but he's so shook up that he's not ready to make any commands right now. He commanded them to be thrown in the furnace, but he invites them to come out. He invites them to come out. So the king, by inviting these men to come out, has admitted that he has been defeated entirely. He is conceding that the gods of Babylon and all the power of his kingdom are not as great as the God of these three Hebrews. So he's admitting their complete defeat when he invites them to come out. It's noted that nothing is said regarding the fourth person coming out. Does not say that four men came out, four were in the fire, but only three men came out of the fire. Why? Well, the Lord would remain with the three as long as He needed to be there to comfort them in the furnace. But when they go out, His visible presence is no longer required. And so the king does not invite the fourth one out. I'm not too sure that he would have wanted to tackle that fourth one. Not too sure that he would have wanted his strong men even to try it. Because this king has been pretty well convinced that God is God. He might have been given to Arminianism before, but he's given it up now. He knows that God is God. A lot of times people say, let God be God. God is God. You don't have to let Him be God. He's going to be God. People say, let go and let God have His way. He's going to have His way. We may not go according to His revealed will in the Bible all the time, but God's will and purpose will be done. So I can just imagine that the king's not too anxious for that fourth man that looks to him like the Son of God to come out. He'd rather talk to these other boys than to talk to God Himself. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came forth out of the midst of the fire. But the fourth one, the pre-incarnate Christ, did not come out of the furnace. You said, what happened to him? Probably just vanished in a split second. He suddenly appeared and he suddenly disappeared. And so that's the way that it went. Now the king's whole plan has backfired on him. He had all these prominent men from all over the empire to come. He made them all bow down when the orchestra played. And if they didn't bow down, then they'd be thrown in the furnace. And so now that he has this large crowd here, he's going to make an example, he thought, out of these three boys. Throw them in the furnace. Roast them good. But you know, because they weren't devoured, the whole thing backfired in the sense that he had all the great men of the world there to witness the fact that God was God. Talk about a fellow being defeated. This king was sorely defeated. His whole program backfired. Let's look at verse 27. And the princes, governors, and captains, and the king's counselors, being gathered together, saw these men, upon whose bodies the fire had no power, nor was a hair of their head singed, neither was their coats changed, nor the smell of fire had passed on them. Now, if you know anything about fire, you don't have to get in the fire to have the smell of smoke in your clothes. If you get anywhere near it, you'll have that. Well, a fellow can be burning leaves over on the next lot, and first thing you know, it'll be smelling like burnt leaves over there where you are. Next thing you know, your clothes will smell like that. And on you go. Smoke has quite a way of penetrating things. But the miracle is all the more great here. Their clothes are not burned. Still got the turbans on. Still got the mantles on. There's not any burn places on their body. Not even a hair on their head that's been singed. Most remarkable. Does the Bible not tell us that God knows the number of our hairs? That not even a hair of our head can fall to the ground without Him taking note of it? Well, here's a good example of where He meant what He said, because not even a hair of the head of these boys has perished. Not even any smell of smoke on their clothing. All these great men are there. They all see that. They all witness that. How do you suppose Nebuchadnezzar felt about that time? He'd probably like to dug him a hole and crawled in and pulled a hole in behind him if he could. But it just simply wasn't possible to do that. He couldn't turn tail and run. He had to stand and face the music himself. And so he wanted all of these three Hebrew boys to bow down. And in a sense, he's going to have to bow down, see, to the God that they serve. So the whole thing's backfired on him. Completely backfired. So the king wanted the most influential men of his realm present when he punished these Hebrews. Now they serve as the most authoritative witnesses to the miracle of God. Only the king's rope burned. I keep saying that. That's all burned in the fire, the king's rope. So now then, let's see what Nebuchadnezzar's going to do there. Then Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He's pronounced a blessing on their God now. Who has sent His angel. He evidently thought that it was no more than an angel, but this was the angel of the Lord, the messenger of the covenant, a theophany, a Christophany, Christ in human form. Who has sent His angel and delivered His servants that trusted in Him. The king realized that they had been delivered because of their faith. Look at that. delivered His servants that trusted in Him, and hath changed the king's word. God can change the heart and the word of a king, and yielded their bodies, that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Well, now there was a God greater than all the gods of Babylon. There was a king, a greater king than Nebuchadnezzar, the greatest monarch in the world at that time. But you know, it must have pained him to admit that. I can imagine that it pained the greatest king in the world to admit that there was a God bigger than all of his gods and a king greater than him. And so he's saying there, well, these are the servants of God. They've trusted in God, and the Lord has delivered them. Think about another test in 1 Kings 18, when you had 850 prophets of Baal and only one prophet of God. And Elijah said, "Let the God that answers by fire be God." And so the fire came down upon the altar that Elijah had made and devoured the sacrifice and licked up the water and the like. And he had prayed before that, "Let it be known that thou art God." And they did know that day. All Israel did know that the Lord was God and not Baal. Well, this was a day when all Babylon knew that the Lord was God and not the gods of Babylon. After all, the Jews' God was greater than the gods of the Babylonians. Sometimes we look at proud men and say there's no way that their hearts could be humbled. Yes, there is. God can do it. May try to witness to somebody and he's awful arrogant and proud, and you say there's no way that we could ever bring that man to see the truth. Yes, God can bring him. See, how do you know? Well, because in Exodus 18 and verse 11, look at Pharaoh. He said, "Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods." So then Pharaoh pretty well realized the same thing that Nebuchadnezzar did there. Now let's go on and pretty well finish our lesson as we go down to verse 29 and 30 here. "Therefore I make a decree." He's going to make a new one now that'll countermand the one before. "Therefore I make a decree that every people, nation, and language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces." So there, the Jews' religion was made the official religion of Babylon. And if you said anything against Jehovah, they'd cut you up in little bitty pieces. Now, these boys didn't ask the king to do that. They did it on their own. That is, he did it on his own. That official edict of his government was not asked for. The law of the Lord is not to be established by the power of the state, but if the state does it, then we cannot stop it either. So neither could they in this particular case. "And their houses shall be made a dunghill," garbage dump, "because there is no other God that can deliver after this sort." So the king forbade anyone in all of his realm to speak against the God of the Hebrews. Be cut in pieces, like he said back in chapter 2 and verse 5. Now, how do you suppose that the Babylonian priests took this? They're there. They're the ones that reported these boys. Did they say, "Well, now this man's disloyal to his own religion. He gone crazy or something? He's supposed to promote our religion. Now he's made this the state religion." You can expect there's going to be trouble coming out of that. So the king commanded the people to worship, but he did not say that he'd worship the God of the Jews. He is too much of a Babylonian to do that. He's not yet been converted, but I believe he will be. He's been convinced that God's God, but he's not converted yet. And so I think that this probably helped the Jews not to fall in line with a lot of the idolatry there in Babylon, this great miracle and all of that. And so then we look at verse 30. "Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon." He put them right back in their old job, if I understand it right. So what we're seeing there is that ultimately right will win. People say, "Oh no, you got to do wrong to get by." No, ultimately right will win in the end, if not now, at a later time. So piety promotes worldly prosperity. That's certainly borne out in these lessons. Now, there's great typical teaching here, and our time is just about gone, but we'll quickly mention that. There are four things that are taught here in the way of a prophetic revelation. The image of the beast corresponds to the image of Antichrist that is set up according to the record in the 13th chapter of Revelation. And the number 66 there is expanded to be 666 in Revelation 13. But the times of the Gentiles begin with an image and the number 66. And it ends with an image and the number 666. Now, the fire there of the furnace is a type of the great tribulation. And I must read this scripture in Zechariah because it is so very good to prove what we're saying. In Zechariah 13, verse 8 and 9, speaking now about the remnant of Israel in the tribulation. And it shall come to pass that in all the land, saith the Lord, two parts therein shall be cut off and die, but the third part shall be left therein. That's the remnant, 144,000. I will bring the third part through the fire, fiery trials of the tribulation, and will refine them as gold is refined, and will try them as gold is tried. They shall call on my name, and I will hear them. I will say, it is my people, and they shall say, the Lord is my God. So the three Hebrews there are a type of the Jewish remnant, that 144,000 that's mentioned in Revelation chapter 7, verse 1 to 4. And so you have here in the fire then a type of the great tribulation. And you have in the Hebrews a type of the Jewish remnant. And of course, the king himself is a type of the Antichrist that will build an image and demand to all people to worship that. Now we know that literally all of that happened back there in the days of these three Hebrew children. Therefore it stands to reason that that's all literally going to happen again a second time. There is going to be a literal image set up in a rebuilt temple in Jerusalem. And all the world must worship the beast and his image on pain of death. And the pain of death in the tribulation will not be the fiery furnace, but it'll be the guillotine, the French guillotine, the head block. I don't know whether you know what I'm talking about or not. If you remember the French Revolution, you probably remember the guillotine, the big old sharp blade that had a lot of weight to it, and they had it up over a man's head, and they'd put him in this wooden device. Then they'd turn loose the rope, and of course it cuts his head off. So you'll have your head cut off. Revelation 20, verse 4, 5, and 6 talks about them that were beheaded for the word of God and for the witness of Jesus. So some will die, but there will be some preserved. Zechariah said 2/3 will die, but 1/3 will be brought through the fire. They'll be preserved like the Hebrews were. There may have been some others cast in that weren't preserved there. There's no record of it, but at least it's possible. But here were three that were preserved. So there's going to be a literal king ruling the world, as much as Nebuchadnezzar was literal. And he's going to demand that the whole world worship him in his image. Except it's going to be the Antichrist and not Nebuchadnezzar. So we're headed for the same time. And the old saying that what has been before will follow hereafter is true. History does repeat itself. There will be a repeating of what we've read here in this chapter. And we're living near the time when all of that is most certainly going to come to pass in the world. All the number systems that we have going now alarm me. Think about the telephone numbers, the car tag numbers, the numbers on Social Security cards, the number of insurance policies, various types of them, the various numbers that the bank has to keep up with us, and the various tax numbers that the government's come up with. We live in a world that's going crazy over numbers. So we need to be very careful. We're nearing the time of the end. Well, that's all of our lesson. I hear the others coming, and the clock has said it's time to stop, and we shall stop.